the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, good evening, everybody. Great to see you all with us. We're continuing a series called Meals and More. And they're based. This series is based in Luke's Gospel, and we're kind of using this as our material for our home groups as well as for our Sunday evening sermon series over the next few weeks. We've been very grateful for this recent book by Tim Chester called A Meal with Jesus. Chester is himself basing this on previous works that have been done by observers of Luke's Gospel, who've noted just what an incredibly significant part food plays in the Gospel of Luke. And if you're in a home group, which I hope you are, you'll be using studies based on some of this material as well as the passages that we've been going through. So we've had the passage read to us beautifully by Dave, Luke chapter 7 verses 36 through 50. It might be that you want to just make sure you've got that in front of you as we go through. Great. Right. Now, just in case you weren't here last week, we were looking at some pointers particularly from Timothy's book, Chester's book, drawing out some of the very helpful thoughts about the significance of food. It might seem a little bit strange that we're doing a series based on food. We're thinking particularly about shared food, about meals. But there's some very significant moments. For example, I think this quote is very helpful. We saw this last week. To share a meal with someone is to indicate that you already are or are becoming friends. It is richly symbolic of friendship, intimacy, and unity. And here's the phrase of Chester's that I love. Food gives tangible form to love. And we heard that, I think, very beautifully illustrated, didn't we, in what Ellie and Emma and Fran were sharing with us. Food gives tangible form to love. And wouldn't it be a tragedy if we go through our lives doing this thing three times a day that we're all built to do and have to do, and this whole business of taking on food and refueling through the day, and as we did that day in, day out, three times a day for our whole lives, we actually missed the significance that it could have a spiritual side to it. It's a tangible form of love. And in the way we eat, we can be expressing something and reinforcing something of spiritual and eternal significance, as well as just doing the kind of the physical act of eating. Now, I think I said last week, I've neglected this perspective, if I'm honest, over the last few years. And I'm very grateful for this chance we have as a church to kind of catch up on it. We saw last week as well that Jesus was getting into trouble in Luke's Gospel because of the way he ate. And that wasn't to do with his table manners, it was to do with his company, particularly who he was eating with. So this was a recurring complaint in Luke's Gospel. Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? If the people you eat with expresses companionship and acceptance and unity and love, then why are you showing compassion and acceptance and unity and love to people who are outside of God's will, living in ways which are sinful or disobedient to God? That was the tax collectors, Pharisees' question to the Lord Jesus. And we saw last week that there was a kind of difference, a major distinction in the way that Jesus saw that issue and the way that the Jewish religious leaders of his day saw that issue. For the Pharisees and the scribes and the rulers, Jewish rulers of the day, they would have seen sin as something to be protected from. You stick on your hazardous materials suit, metaphorically. You seal yourself away from sinful people. And we saw last week that they had this kind of worldview that said the reason they'd been under foreign occupation for so many centuries by so many various superpowers was because they had sinned. And they were absolutely right. That was why they'd been under foreign occupation for so many years. So the response was, then let's get clean. That's a great response. Let's make ourselves clean by keeping the law. That's a great response. But then let's also keep ourselves clean by avoiding anybody who we think might be spiritually, ceremonially dirty. Let's basically seal ourselves away from people who might pollute us. That was their attitude. And that's why Jesus puzzled them so much, because Jesus was coming at it from a completely different perspective. Jesus was seeing not sin as contagious, but holiness as contagious. He says, if when Jesus touched people, he made them clean. When he touched lepers, they were cleaned. When he approached sinful people, they repented and started living differently. And that's Jesus' attitude. And remember in Luke 5 that we were looking at last Sunday night, if you were here, he's using the analogy of a doctor, saying it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. And he pictures himself as the great physician who's come to heal the sick. But a doctor who just shouts at you from behind a screen isn't much of a doctor. The kind of doctor you need is the doctor who looks at you, touches you, engages with you, and relates in a real way that can heal you. That's what Jesus was doing. But it was modeled through the way he ate, and that's what was causing him problems. And we pick that issue up again in this chapter, Luke chapter 7. So Dave read these verses for us. If this man were a prophet, and isn't it a fantastic irony at this moment where Simon's going, thinking, if this man were a prophet, and what's Jesus' response? To read his mind. I love the way Luke goes, Jesus answered him, and of course he hasn't said anything. Jesus answered his thoughts. And you imagine Simon's surprise at the fact if he was a prophet, and he knows exactly what he's thinking. If this man were a prophet, he'd know who's touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. For Simon, this is a woman who should be quarantined. For Jesus, this is a woman who needs to be engaged with and loved and forgiven and healed and restored. And that's the big tension that's going to continue just growing and growing throughout Luke's gospel. One of the writers that Chester's based his work on is the monastic writer, Robert Caris. And he put it this way, as we saw last week again. In Luke's gospel, Jesus got himself killed because of the way he ate, because of the company he kept when he ate. And we're just going to see that developed a little bit this week. Now, Steve Timmis is often Tim Chester's mate in writing. That's why I keep calling Tim Chester Steve Timmis. Forgive me. But Chester does a great job in this book of kind of contextualizing this little scene. And I can't do better than just read what he writes. So let me just read this for you. So he says this. Imagine you're at a dinner party. The host is a respectable church leader and local councillor who lives in a big house on the posh side of town. Tonight the dinner party is in honour of a visiting speaker. You're glad to have been invited because there's been a lot of talk about this man. He's been causing something of a stir with his radical views. Some people won't have anything to do with him, but you've got an open mind. It's good to have an opportunity to find out what he's really like. You hear the doorbell ring, but you think nothing of it until a woman pushes her way into the room. You see the despairing face of the host's wife. This new arrival is wearing a tight-fitting, low-cut blouse, a skirt that is way too short, and stiletto shoes. She's painted up to the nines, and she totters slightly as she walks. She's probably had one too many to drink. She looks like the sort of woman who stands on street corners. She goes straight to the visiting speaker and throws her arms around him, clasping his head to her bosom. "I'll always be yours," you hear her mumble. She begins to massage his shoulders, and it's then that you notice she's crying, her mascara streaking down her cheeks. Everyone in the room seems to freeze. What a thing for a respectable person to have to endure. You feel for him. How embarrassing. But instead of pushing her away, he reaches up and puts his arms around her. He says something to her that sounds like, "And you're mine." But he can't have said that. It's obvious what kind of woman she is. He can surely see that for himself. He ought to show some discernment. She might think it's a come-on. Maybe it is. Maybe he's one of her customers. This visiting speaker clearly has big problems. And that's how Chester contextualizes this in our kind of modern setting. That would have been probably a similar kind of thing to the verse in Luke 7 that we have just read. That's the kind of situation, that kind of embarrassment, that kind of ambiguity, that kind of inappropriateness. That's what was going on in this situation. Two questions from this passage, and then I'm going to sit down. Here's question one that I think this passage is asking us, and it's this. Have we welcomed Jesus? I think that's one of the big questions of this passage. It's certainly the big question that's asked of Simon. Have we welcomed Jesus? And from what Jesus says to Simon in verses 44 to 46, clearly he hasn't. Now, there would have been three very common markers of hospitality in the first century Middle East. And Simon, as we read, has failed all three. He's failed all three. So the first one would have been he would have given Jesus some water to wash his feet with. dusty culture, sandals, no tarmac roads, feet got very dirty when you walked somewhere, come into someone's house, the first thing you do is that you would give someone water to wash their feet, or if you were quite wealthy, even offer a servant to wash their feet for them. Simon hadn't done that. Second thing that would normally have been done would have been, you would have kissed the person coming through the door. Now, we still do that, don't we, across the genders. It would have been a male-on-male thing as well in the first century. The equivalent today would have been, we'd give someone a peck on the cheek or we'd shake their hands as they came through the door of our houses. Simon hadn't extended that basic courtesy either. And the third thing you would do in that culture is offer someone a little bit of oil, fragranced oil, just to put on their heads. That would, I guess, be the equivalent of putting some nice soap in the cloakroom when someone arrives. They want to wash their hands and just make themselves feel nice and freshen up a bit. Simon's done none of those things for Jesus in this passage. So although he's his host, he's Christ's host, he's actually not acting like a host. He's acting like a pretty substandard, begrudging kind of host. It's hospitality, but barely hospitality. He's really not doing what he should have done to be a host in this setting. And it's worth asking the question, isn't it? Why not? Why is Simon not welcoming Jesus properly? He's asked him to come, so why is he not welcoming him properly? Well, we saw this verse last week, and particularly this phrase. We thought last week, we said, well, there's lots of phrases in the New Testament about what the Son of Man, which is one of Jesus' favorite titles for himself, the kind of ultimate man, the man of man's, what he's come to do. So the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Or the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. But also in the New Testament, there's this phrase, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And that's one of the things that the Pharisees are saying about Jesus. He comes eating and drinking. And what I didn't realize before I read Chester was this, that when that phrase is being used, it's actually a quote. And it's a quote from the law, the Old Testament law, the book of Deuteronomy. And it's from this chapter, Deuteronomy 21, verses 20 to 21. And it's describing what you should do when a son of Israel, a boy, a teenager probably, in the camp, is just kicking off and being really rebellious. So you might say, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. And what's the mark of a rebellious son? Well, he's profligate and a drunkard. And when the Pharisees are saying of Jesus, he just comes eating and drinking, he's a glutton and a drunkard, that's the verse they're quoting. So effectively they're saying, this Jesus is a rebellious son of Israel. This is like this is one of the guys we were warned about in the Mosaic law. This is the kind of troublemaker who's going to derail the whole community. This man is trouble. He's a glutton and a drunkard. That's the reference. So if that's what Simon thinks Jesus is, it's kind of no wonder that his welcome of Jesus into his home is a little bit half-hearted. Might be that he's treating Jesus as a kind of commodity. He wants to come and maybe show him off to his friends, or he wants to be the one who stages the kind of forum in which his fellow Pharisees can rip this new preacher apart. And having him in his home is just the kind of price he's got to pay for that. But he's not going to do all the stuff that hospitality should do, show that there's unity and love and acceptance. He's not going to extend that kind of welcome to Jesus. So there is no foot washing, and there is no greeting kiss, and there is no fragranced oil for Jesus. He's tolerating his presence, but just barely. And he's tolerating it probably for Simon's own reasons and motives, which, if you think about it, is probably the way that this woman who comes in has been treated by men all her life. The phrase a sinful woman, probably, it's not absolutely certain, but it probably meant she was a prostitute. Not absolutely certain, but she certainly would have been a woman of ill sexual repute, either for money or for other reasons. But that's probably what it meant. So most of her life, she would have had men wanting to extend intimacy to her, but only for their own benefit. Wanting to extend intimacy to her, but in no way suggesting that she was going to be accepted by them, or equal with them, or loved by them, or forgiven by them. She was welcomed in on their terms, on a very temporary, limited basis, but purely for their benefit. The way that she'd been treated by others is the way that Simon, at this point, is treating Jesus. He hadn't really welcomed the Lord Jesus Christ. Whereas the contrast is, bizarrely, ironically, this sinful woman had welcomed Jesus. Everything that Simon, as the host, should have done but didn't, she, as the usurper, had done. She's a brilliant host to Jesus, even though this isn't her house. So look at what she does. You see this woman, Jesus says? She didn't just wash my feet. She wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. Now that is foot washing. She didn't just give me a kind of cursory welcome kiss on the cheek. Since I've come in, she's not stopped kissing my feet. What kind of welcome is that? She didn't just give me a little bit of perfume and invite me to go and do what I wanted with it. She's poured a jar of the stuff all over my feet. She's extended this phenomenal, loving welcome to Jesus, which absolutely puts his actual host to shame. So if we know why Simon hadn't welcomed Jesus as he should have done, why has this woman welcomed Jesus so effusively, so fully? And this is what she's saying, isn't it? This is what is going on with this welcome. She says to Jesus, well, listen, I know I'm a mess. She's standing weeping. I know I'm a mess. She knows that the life she's living is not a good way to live. She knows that she's broken. She knows that she's messed up. She knows that she's dirty. She doesn't need to be told that. She knows that she's a mess. But she also knows that Jesus welcomes people like her. She may have heard that Jesus actually ate with a tax collector called Levi, the passage we looked at last week in Luke chapter 5. She may have heard Jesus proclaim good news to the poor, like it says in chapter 7, verse 22. She may have seen Jesus do the kinds of things that Jesus tells John the Baptist's disciples to report back to him. Lame walking, blind seeing, those with leprosy cleansed, the deaf hearing, the dead raised. She's seen Jesus touch people who he should have nothing to do with, and clean and restore and heal. And she thinks, well, if he's done that for them, he will do that for me. So she knows that Jesus welcomes people like her, people who are a mess, who are broken inside. So she comes to him, and she welcomes him. That's what this lavish hospitality that she's extending to him, not even in her own home, is about, isn't it? She welcomes him, and she receives his forgiveness, this passage tells us. Now, here's one more detail from this whole deal that I hadn't really picked up before preparing for this series. We've seen this verse, Son of Man came eating and drinking, that's repeated just before this passage. We read it, Luke 7:34, and we saw that it's a kind of quotation of this passage in Deuteronomy 21. What was Israel told to do to a son like this? This law would have been given when they were still in the wilderness. They had to do this deal of getting across the desert into the promised lands. If there was trouble in the camp, it could have been really serious and derailed it. Suddenly you've got a stubborn son who is acting like a glutton and a drunkard, who's dishonoring God and derailing the agenda and threatening the whole deal. What do you do with someone like that? Well, you do this to them. This is how that passage continues. All the men of this town are to stone him to death. You mustn't leave the body hanging on the pole overnight. Be sure to bury it that same day, because anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. And now we start to understand what the Pharisees are thinking about Jesus. This is a guy who doesn't just eat and drink with sinners. We're going to label him, therefore, as a glutton and a drunkard. We're going to see in his life the dangers that we were warned about right back in Deuteronomy 21. And we know what we need to do with a guy like this who's going to derail the whole show. We need to get him hung up on a pole. We need to take him out of the way. We need to see him hang under a curse. And of course, it's a horrible irony, but for us, it's a beautiful, life-saving irony, isn't it? The irony for us is that they thought they were getting rid of a stubborn, rebellious son of Israel, when in fact they were the stubborn, rebellious, hard-hearted sons and daughters of Israel. But they pressed on with their plan and saw this man killed and hung on a tree under a curse. But when that happens, it was their sins that were going to be forgiven through that very act. They thought they were crucifying a stubborn, rebellious one, but in fact, his death led to the forgiveness of their stubborn rebelliousness, and my stubborn rebelliousness, and your stubborn rebelliousness, and this sinful woman's stubborn rebelliousness in time. Isn't it amazing the way that just kind of turns around on itself? this instinct. So she knows she's a mess, and she knows Jesus welcomes people who are a mess like me and like you and like her. And so she welcomes him lavishly and clearly and receives his forgiveness in this passage, as they read for us, as Christ proclaims her forgiveness over him. And because she is so forgiven, she loves. And that's the point of that tiny little mini parable, isn't it? Who loves more? The person who's been forgiven a little, or the person who's been forgiven a great big lot? And it's a no-brainer for Simon, isn't it? The person who's been forgiven a lot. And this is her response to being forgiven by Jesus. She loves and welcomes others as Jesus has loved and welcomed her. She loves and welcomes others as Jesus has loved and welcomed her. So let's just follow that through, and let's ask ourselves the question at the top of the screen. Is this us? Have we welcomed Jesus in the same way that this sinful woman welcomes Jesus in this passage? Let's just track down through that, just for ourselves personally. Do we acknowledge that we're a mess? Because Simon doesn't in this story, doesn't he? Simon thinks he's all right, and she's a mess, but he's not willing to acknowledge his own messed upness, his own hard-heartedness, his rebellion, his sinfulness. Do we believe that Jesus welcomes people like us? Sometimes we find that hard to believe, doesn't he? That someone as lovely as Jesus, the living God, will want anything to do with someone like us. But Luke's gospel tells us that he does. Do we believe that? So do we welcome him and receive his forgiveness? And does our love for him reflect the forgiveness that we've received from him? And if all that has gone on, does that love spill over into a love and a forgiveness and an acceptance of others? As you have been forgiven, so forgive others. Does that principle ring true in our lives? And this is a lovely verse, isn't it? I love the way this is Luke 7:47. If you're an aircraft spotter like me, you'll know the 747 is one of the biggest aircraft in the sky, the jumbo jet. And this is a jumbo jet of a verse, isn't it? Her many sins have been forgiven as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. If we walk around with hard, judgmental hearts towards others that we consider to be less together than we are, all we're doing is showing that we have been forgiven little, and therefore we are loving little. If we walk around with hearts full of compassion and love for people we lock eyes with, it probably suggests that we know that we were broken and remain broken. We're getting fixed, but we're still pretty broken people. And we've received the love and the forgiveness and the restoration of the Lord Jesus Christ. So our second final question this evening is this. Are we welcoming fellow sinners as Jesus has welcomed us? And that's where the community part of this deal comes in, doesn't it? That's the gist of the story. If we know ourselves to be loved and forgiven, welcomed by Christ, are we showing that loving, forgiving welcome to others? And of course, we know already in this series, don't we, that one of the best ways we show love, one of the best ways we show forgiveness, one of the best ways we show that sense of community to others could be through the way we extend hospitality, the way we share food with one another, as we've already seen. This was, again, a quote we saw last week, but just to remind ourselves of it. Community and mission are more than meals, Chester says, but it's hard to envisage them without meals. If you share a meal and have a passion for Jesus, you will be building up the Christian community and reaching out in mission. One of the best ways we can show that sense of community, that love, that forgiveness, that acceptance, that companionship in our brokenness, but in our forgiveness, that companionship in our love and our welcome by Christ, is to eat with others, is to show that tangible form of love that can come through shared food. It's a powerful symbol, isn't it? Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a lovely little book. I read it when I was on my sabbatical a few years ago, called Life Together. And Bonhoeffer says this, forgive his exclusive male-only language, but this was the habit of his day. And he writes this in Life Together. Thank God for what he gives us daily. Brothers who will go on living with us through sin and under the blessing of his grace. Is the divine gift of Christian fellowship anything less than this, or even on even the most difficult and distressing day? Even when sin and misunderstanding burden the communal life, is not the sinning brother still a brother with whom I too stand under the word of Christ. I love that phrase. Even when sin and misunderstanding burden the communal life, isn't the sinning brother still a brother with whom I too stand under the word of Christ? And sometimes fellowship can feel like that, can't it? Sometimes fellowship can feel like it's burdened by sin and by misunderstanding and by brokenness. The very act of offering hospitality can sometimes be pretty costly. And I'm actually quite shielded from that, really, because my wife does most of the shopping and cooking in my house, to my shame. It just so happens, this wasn't deliberate, was it? It just happens that yesterday we had people for lunch today, and we've got people for tea tomorrow night, and on Tuesday night. So there's been quite a lot of shopping to do. And just so happens that I did it this weekend. That's dumb luck, because normally it's not me. And I'm on a kind of anti-supermarket kick at the moment, so I thought, right, I'm going to do this, you know, the hard way, on my bicycle with my rucksack. And I'm not going to go to the supermarket. I'm going to go to all these little shops on Sybil Street and pick what I need from here and there. And spent a huge chunk of yesterday morning doing that. I'm thinking, oh, this shopping thing's hard work. It really is hard work. We had home group at our house on Wednesday, just opening our home to our home group, as loads of us would have done. And we had one of those incidents on Wednesday that you are going to have when you open your house up, aren't you, to people. Lovely, clean floor in our front room. Big cup of coffee all over the middle of our lounge carpet. And I did my best to smother and to cloak my irritation on Wednesday night when that happened. And it happens, you know, you'll know this, won't you, if you open your house. It happens quite a lot. And I did my best to smother my irritation and to look all gracious and lovely, not, I'm sure, fooling anybody for a single moment at that time. And I was just getting, in my heart, I was getting quite grumpy about just the cost of this, you know. And this, isn't this trivial? Isn't it stupid? Just what I'm saying, I'm ashamed as I share it. But I was thinking, dirty carpet and blah, 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 blah. Why can't people be more careful? Blah, 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 blah. And then it struck me a little bit later on, I thought, I'm extending this welcome, and a welcome comes at a cost. And the cost of this welcome for me at this point, for us, has been a stained carpet, a coffee-stained carpet. God the Father extends a welcome to me and you, and the cost of that welcome for him wasn't a coffee-stained carpet, it was a blood-stained cross. That's how much his hospitality of us actually costs. And I'm moaning about a coffee stain. I'm moaning about a sore shoulder from some heavy potatoes that I've carried home. Isn't it remarkable the way that something as simple as feeding people or welcoming people into our homes can be what Chester calls, and we finish with this, a sacrament of forgiveness. We looked at the word sacrament last week, and we saw it was originally a kind of oath of allegiance in the military, but it came to be known as a physical act that symbolizes a spiritual reality. Have you ever thought of hospitality as a sacrament, a physical act that is symbolizing the spiritual reality that we welcome one another with all the cost that's involved in that, all the occasional mess that's involved in that, all the inconvenience and the loss of time that's involved in that? We extend our hospitality gladly and gratefully and lovingly and openly and repeatedly, in part because that's the kind of welcome we've received from the living God, but magnified a millionfold. The cost that he paid to welcome us has just been immense. Let's reflect it in the way that we welcome one another into our homes and into our lives.